It's late December in Alaska, and the sun's about to set for the final time this year. A host of strange events precede the sun's dipping below the horizon, including strange animal behavior, possible water contamination, and 8 scientists working at an Arctic research station disappear from their posts. They're later found by a local one frozen, who is led to their dead bodies by a man named Travis, who is also deceased. Working the case is Liz Danvers, a local cop with a complex web of relationships to the officers working in her department. Joining her is Evangeline Navarro, who used to work on the same force but was transferred to another branch of police work because she could not let go the disappearance of a Native woman 6 years ago. There's an apparent connection between the murdered woman and the 8 scientists. Both cases involved an indigenous woman missing her tongue.
From the dusty mesa, her looming shadow.
Welcome to The World We Deserve, the officially unofficial podcast for True Detective on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 4, Episode 1, Night of Night Country. And I guess it's called Night Country Part 1. At least it was Sunday night when I watched it. We'll see if they go back and retroactively change those titles. But we're here to talk about the episode at length. Where do you want to start off with this conversation?
I guess, what did we think? True Detective is back on the air.
I quite liked it. I thought this felt like a True Detective episode to me, both in quality and content, I guess. This new setting is unsettling, which I like. I will say it does feel slightly different from True Detective in some ways. It feels much more like horror-based, perhaps even more supernatural. At least up front, it's preloading a lot of its supernatural stuff, because there was definitely supernatural hints in the first season, third season, second season, all of that stuff. But this is a little more front and center here. But that didn't put me off. I think I'm enjoying it so far.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's what defines the True Detective kind of feel, is a solid, you know, solid police work combined with a little Scooby-Doo. You got to have a weird cult that's worshiping some eldritch god. You got to have guys walking around in animal masks murdering people. You got to have ghosts from war haunting a person at night while they're losing their mind. You have to have that kind of Lovecraftian quality, and I felt like this definitely shone through. Especially, it's just like, and I don't even know if I need it to be True Detective. I was listening to the official podcast, and Issa Lopez mentioned that it's not like HBO is like, hey, we need a new True Detective. What do you got for us? It was more like she brought this project called Night Detective to HBO Max, and they're like, oh, we actually like that. Would you be willing to produce it under True Detective, you know, banner as just like a marketing thing? You know, like it's like when they slap Mustang on a new car, you know, it's not literally the same thing that what's his face is driving in Bullet, you know, Steve McQueen. So that's literally the same car, right? It's just kind of a spiritual association with the with the brand. So for that, it's like, yeah, it's kind of amazing. It fits the project so well, and I know she definitely went through and punched it up and put some of those connections, more of a True Detective-ish connections, into it once she got that project. So, yeah, I love it. It's such a contrast to the previous works. Although, also, True Detective covered a lot of ground, you know. Season one was nothing like season two, which was nothing like season three. So. Is this a more, you know, I've seen one episode. Is this a more extreme departure just because it's set in Alaska? It's got snow for the first time. I don't know, but I thought it felt like of a piece too.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, let's maybe talk about what we know of the investigation so far. Some of the facts on the ground, maybe how they're potentially connected. Do a little theorizing, because that stuff is always fun. And boy, there's a lot of theorizing happening out there on the internet. The psychosphere is getting real stinky.
Yeah.
Stinky as those clothes in the washer.
Maybe lead with one that I thought was the most interesting, because we were asking about like these possible connections to season one of True Detective. And on the instant take portions, we were talking about the Lone Star beer can, and I'm sure there'll be others, right? But a lot of people noticed that Russ Cole in season one, I believe episode four, mentions that his father is from Alaska and his name is Travis.
Yep.
And here we have a person who's been dead for I don't know how many years, but I don't think he died last week from everyone's reaction to it. Mm-hmm. Passing resemblance to Matthew McConaughey's kind of long, stringy hair sure. version of the Russ Cole character. He's communicating with this woman, Rose. What do you make of this?
So I kind of like it just as a tie-in. I don't know that they need to be like super explicit about it, but if you just want to drop a hint like that, let people theorize about it, I think that's cool. It'll be interesting if they try and make that connection explicit, though, because that it just seems unnecessary to me.
Like I said, that maybe the hint of it is enough. Because the other thing that people pointed out is, I guess in the final episode of True Detective season one, when, you know, Russ and Marty are reflecting over their experiences in Carcosa, and Russ had, you know, got stabbed, had a near-death experience, he said that he felt like his father's presence.
Hmm.
Which would kind of mean it's not the first time that he's manifested to someone alive. I don't know. I think it's super interesting to think about. The other connections that I saw were the spirals you pointed out. You know, Jodie Foster is sitting in the middle of a Carcosa Yellow King spiral of evidence. There's spirals, like I noticed when Officer Navarro is aggressively fucking the dude. There is a lot of spirals on his the bed sheets. Like pillows that are behind his head and all that stuff, kind of very geometric, triangular, more indigenous looking spirals, but spirals nonetheless. And, you know, a lot of the animal imagery, animal skins, antlers, bones, skulls, especially in the credit sequence. I thought those are allusions, maybe the first season of True Detective, but I don't know. Maybe we'll see more.
And maybe the almost, I guess, posed sort of nature of the victims. In this, you know, at the very end of the episode, we see them sort of frozen in the ice. And you know, in the first season, you find the woman tied to the tree and she's got the spiral on her. There's something evocative there, I think.
A performance. Some people said that the... I keep on wanting to call him Kevin, but it's not. It's...
Travis.
The Travis character, when he's appearing to Rose, is doing this kind of interpretive dance.
Yeah.
And that this was like pantomiming the positions of the dead people or maybe reenacting their death. I don't know that we can confidently state that just from a couple seconds of dead bodies frozen in some kind of shock and horror.
Yeah, but on the other hand, I want to contextualize it because that was maybe the thing that took me out of this episode the most is that weird
interpretive dance.
Yeah, I don't know. Not a huge fan of that, but also it didn't ruin the episode for me or anything. I don't care that much. But I do want to know why this ghost decides to dance.
So there's three central kind of investigations, mysteries, interconnected weird things happening here. The disappearances at the Saul Lal station, the Ann K disappearance / murder from 6 years ago, and then a Travis appearing to Rose. You're listening to The World We Deserve. We'll be right back.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre, We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're back with more of The World We Deserve. Let's start off with the Salal station. I mentioned on Instant Podcast that is a Hebrew word for to be or to grow black.
Hmm.
And I also mentioned it was the name of an island in an Edgar Allan Poe novel, the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket. Did you look at it to see any of this stuff?
This is the most True Detective thing that's ever happened, right? This is the season in a nutshell. So Edgar Allan Poe wrote this book called The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket. And Jules Verne decided that he was just going to write the sequel to this thing.
Not even a spiritual sequel. Just like, nope, this is the continuation of the tale. And
it's called
the
Antarctic Mystery. And he tells the tale of these people looking for this island of Salal, where Arthur Gordon Pym was supposed to have, I guess, disappeared. I don't know. I read the chapter that deals with their discovery of the island. And apparently when they arrive at this island, the people, the animals, everything that was described by Pym's diary is nowhere to be found.
Yeah.
They can't find any of them. And then they apparently find the remains of some people, and they find perhaps the captain's or Pym's dog's collar that tell them, okay, he was here. And they speculate that they were killed by perhaps a natural event. In that chapter, they say it was perhaps an earthquake destroyed the island and killed the inhabitants. But it was weird because the earthquake seems to have happened after the people were killed and the animals disappeared and all that. And then later in the book, I guess they sort of come to the conclusion on their own. I think they're speculating, but they come to the idea that they might have been killed by some disease.
So I guess in subsequent chapters, once they leave the island of Salal, they pick up a magnetic disturbance and they follow it and they find this massive sphinx sphinx made out of ice.
Okay.
That has an insanely strong magnetic field, and they find, I guess, the wreckage of Pym's boat around that, and they surmise that this magnetic field is so strong, it attracted the metal that was in the boats and in the men, and it dashed them against it and destroyed them. And the reason they didn't die is because they used the native-built boat that had no metal in it.
Gotcha.
So I thought that was interesting, especially when the natives of Tsalal Island are described as, like, jet black, like Vanta black. And not just, like, their skin, like, their gums and their teeth are also black. There's, like, and strange for an Antarctic people, they don't are familiar with the concept of white. The color white doesn't exist on this island. I thought that was kind of an interesting, like, othering type of commentary, especially when you're talking about this is kind of missing indigenous, you know, women. Mm-hmm. There's a big theme of this. But yeah, that is some mysterious stuff to pin into a True Detective backstory.
And obviously, you know, it kind of sets the stage with the disappearance of all these scientists, right? You arrive at Tsalal and it's empty. We expected there to be something here.
Yeah. And you can't talk about the Tsalal incident with talking about the what apparently was the last sunset. There's some sort of Inuit hunter that's out stalking some caribou. They're at the precipice of a cliff where the sun's about to set. And right as the sun starts dipping below the sky, the caribou look like they're disturbed. They're sniffing the air. The hunter himself, they cut back to his POV, and he flares his nostrils. He smells something, too. And then as the sun sets, the caribou all bellow, and they run off the cliff into the direction of the setting sun.
Mm-hmm.
As almost whatever is coming in the darkness is too much for a living thing to bear.
Which is interesting, I guess, with the quote at the beginning of this that apparently is not a real quote. It's not quoting anybody. It's written by Issa, where it says basically, you know, the you can't even imagine what the night can dream up in the hours where God is not even awake. I forget the exact wording, but
yeah, for we do not know what beast the night dreams when its hours grow too long for even God to be awake.
Yeah, so you can imagine whatever those beasts are terrifying enough for these caribou to just end themselves.
I know, lemming style. I kind of want to start doing that. And whenever I have a sick quote that I want to attribute but make it seem extra smart, I just invent a really cool name and be like, yeah, that person said it.
So not this is me. Not an invented
not
name.
Myself. Oh, it's not? Is this an attributed quote to a real person?
So the quote is fake. The name is real. This Hildred Castain guy is apparently the narrator in one of the short stories from Robert Chambers' Yellow King book, or King and Yellow book. It's from the story, The Repairer of Reputations. He's the narrator. So it's tying it back to, you know, season one with the King and Yellow stuff. Sort of directly, but like by proxy, by a quote that he never said, because it's not in the short story at all.
Well, I heard Albert Einstein once said, "Bald move makes some sick ass podcasts. Those boys, wicked smart."
Yeah.
So, you know, great man. Who am I to argue with it? And they mentioned that this is set, so this is Ennis, Alaska. It's 350 miles north of the Arctic Circle. Simultaneously, as these caribou are running for their life, well, they're running to their death at the edge of the cliff, at the Tsalal Research Station, just utter normal things are happening. They're settling into a Ferris Bueller marathon. They're popping popcorn, analyzing old data. They're greeting each other cordially. The biggest dispute, maybe somebody is slightly put out that somebody's bringing a load of laundry too late the laundry day. But they're greeting each other cordially. They're working out. One guy's making a TikTok video about a sandwich in Spanish. And suddenly a guy named Clark is seized by seizures and whispers she's awake just as the power cuts.
Oh, man. There's so much to dig into here. It spans kind of the rest of the episode. I want to talk about the state of Clark in this scene, because it's interesting. He's wearing the coat. He's wearing the coat.
The coat, yep.
Yeah, the one with the smiley face on the shoulder, the one potentially, I don't want to say for sure was Anne's, mm-hmm. Anne's coat, but I think, I mean, that's what the episode is trying to imply, is that it, this is Anne's coat.
Sure.
And that coat has snow on it. Fresh,
like he's been recently outside.
Snow. Yes. That I find interesting. Why would he be outside?
There is, and it's also maybe there's some kind of environmental exposure. We were joking about M. Night Shyamalan's The Happening, but it mm-hmm. kind of feels that way, that like these caribou smelt something, the hunter smelt something. I'm very interested to see what, do we ever find that hunter? Like later on in the season, will we hear from him, or did he follow them off the cliff? This guy, the only one that apparently was outside, is the one that's affected. You know, is there something, other characters mentioned that the water has gone to shit in the last 3 days, which mm-hmm. directly connects to the sun disappearing. Yeah. Like if it, you know, if you want to hang your hat on something empirical, my guess would be radiation, some kind of groundwater contamination,
toxic gas, some
kind of, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Something
that they, or a novel pathogen, because the other thing we found about the Salal Institute is they're doing a lot of things. They're doing climate science, looking at climate change, studying biodiversity and the lack thereof in Alaska wilderness. But Peter, who's kind of like been given by Liz this project to investigate them, like a book report, he concludes that what they're really looking for is the origins of life on planet Earth. And they're mm-hmm. also drilling all these ice core samples.
Although, can we note that this is a man who names his son Darwin? So he might be biased.
They're true. It's an interesting narrative hook that we're talking about. Like, yeah, the uh-huh. origin of the species and the kid's name's Darwin. But they also have these ice core samples. And the other thing I thought is like, what if they have unwittingly unlocked some kind of ancient pathogen in this ice drilling that they're doing? Because that's a real fear that I think scientists have, is like as the permafrost defrost due to climate change, like there could be bacteria and viruses that have been locked away there for millions and millions of years that we might have lost our defenses to, or maybe we never, you know, they've been locked away since before the people walked over on the land bridge. You know, there's, I don't know, it's scary stuff when you're fucking with planetary systems have been stable for hundreds of thousands of years. So yeah, I'm not ready to go quite to, you know, bed knobs and broomsticks and ghosts and whatnot. I'm gonna keep my rational hat on for at least one episode. But
some of the speculation that's going on out there is, I think, interesting and admirable. Mm-hmm. If maybe not to my tastes, because there are some stuff out there that's like, oh yeah, they unleashed some pathogen, which I could see perhaps.
Sure.
The other thing is there's some kind of connection to a Lovecraft thing that I read, where like these star-shaped, let's call them entities, I think. I don't, there's some connection to like some alien species that was fucking around with life and kind of accidentally created humanity. And I forget exactly what it is, but there's some kind of connection to a star-shaped material. And we see all these star-shaped stab wounds. We see the polar bear with the star-shaped stab on its eye. There's a lot of star-like stuff happening here. I don't remember the exact details. Maybe one of these weeks, if we can go further down that rabbit hole, we'll pull it. But that stuff is interesting. It could be aliens, is what I'm saying. Could be aliens.
Could be aliens.
Yeah.
And December 20th... Oh, go ahead.
Well, let me say the other thing that I thought was interesting when you look at Anne Kay, who's the woman who was murdered 6 years ago or so, is her seeming... the mantle she took up in the town was an eco-activist. She, in the intro, you can kind of see... a protest sign, I guess, that's sort of floating in the water, says save our water or something like that, protect our water, tying it back to Anne. And I think that's interesting, because if you want to talk about contaminants, well, she might have been fighting against them. She might have been killed for that. There's a lot of implications there.
Oh, 100%. So a few days later, December 20th, a guy who's making his regular delivery to the station complains that nobody's coming out to help him unload the Doritos and whatever else they're getting. And he goes in and he finds the place looking strangely abandoned, and he's startled to find a severed human tongue underneath the sandwich prep area of the Slaw Research Station, which then obviously gets the Alaskan police, the APF, the Alaskan police force, I guess. This is a fictitious Alaskan police body.
Okay.
There is not, cool. Like, I think there's, like, an Alaskan, like, I don't know. I couldn't find any APF. I think they're using fictitious just so they can have some kind of jurisdictional differences, but it can all be, they can just it's made up town, made up police forces and all that stuff. But they show up to investigate. You see Liz kind of sparring this guy named Hank Pryor. Do you get it? Pryor? He's the Pryor relationship.
Okay.
Sure. I think that's what they're going for. And he's kind of dismissive about all this, you know, as being like, oh, you know, they might have just disappeared immediately. She uses her incredible mom skills of knowing when mayonnaise goes bad and how long moldy laundry takes to stink up that bad in a washer to be like, nah, these guys have been missing at least 2, if not 3 days.
Mm-hmm. And her extensive knowledge of native women's tongues.
True. There is that as well. What did you make of her extreme reaction to the Beatles?
Clearly, this is a trauma response of some kind. Yeah. She's triggered by this song. And I have some speculation. I've seen some speculation. I think it's
me too.
Probably about as close as we can get without more information, that this is somehow connected to the death of her adopted daughter's father.
Mm-hmm.
And there are hints of that. We don't really get a lot of information on that in this episode, but there's definitely some hints to tell us that something bad happened there. It's probably related to a drunk driving incident, and it probably has something to do with her response to this song.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, we'll just go ahead and spell it out. People have said that it's probably the song that was playing when that happened, or maybe it was stuck on repeat in the car and she responded to the scene. We'll have to find out, but sure. Some kind of connection to that seems probable, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was one of the early parts of humor where she's, you know, it's like clearly she's traumatized by it, but her just desperately trying to turn off as this Peter guy narrates all. No, we tried that. That doesn't open. Nope, that doesn't need it there. And you can see the exact point where he just like, oh, fuck it. I don't care that much. And she just continues to rip into it till she finds it.
And then the thing that really tells me that this is not normal behavior, I mean, A, it's how fast she runs to this song and identifies we need to shut this off. But B, the way she shuts it off. Normal people would open that compartment. They would see a DVD player. They would press the stop button. They would unplug it, maybe. She's just hammering on it with her fist.
Right, like a feral animal.
Like monkey who sees something nasty they don't like, just smash it, you know?
Yeah. I got some Marge Gunderson feel from Jodie Foster's character here because, like, she's on a next level. Like, one guy's like, ah, fuck it. We'll see if they come back in a couple days. And the other guy can't even figure out how to turn off a TV that's blaring. And she's like, who's funding this place? You know, 3 seconds on the scene, she's already thinking, let's follow the money. Let's figure out what's going on here. I thought it was pretty impressive. Because she assigns this book report to Peter and he gives it back to us, we get a whole bunch of information dumped to us as an audience. Slaw Station has been running for 18 years. They're researching the impact of the climate change on, among other things. There's 8 researchers from all over the world. All men. There's 8 guys with experts from geology, geophysics, geobiology, paleomicrobiology, environmental chemistry, biophysics, and structural biology. And as we explore the base, we see a facility where they're storing their ice core samples, which I thought is interesting. It's like one of those high security, you got to badge your way through, but the key was just tied to the lock, essentially. They have a guy's badge hanging from it, implying that maybe that there a security breach could be connected to the disappearance, the sloppy security.
Yeah, so there's something interesting that happens when the delivery guy shows up too. it's very horror-like, but it's also informational, I think. When he shows up, the facility's empty, except somebody runs through the hallway.
Oh, yes, I forgot to mention that. Yeah, there is a potential one of these eight scientists not dead.
To me, when I pause that and I look at it, I couldn't identify the patch on the coat, but the color of that person's coat is perhaps identical to the color of the
really
coat. Yeah,
really interesting,
which means maybe Clark is running around there somewhere, and he could be the source of this thing and the person who murdered them all. Who knows?
A couple other things that we find: there's a whiteboard with calculations, and a big scrawl that says "We are all dead." Now, when we were going through the populated base in the cold open, we saw that this guy looking at these numbers, and the guy comes in, is like, "Oh, you're looking at new data?" He's like, "No, old data." But he had just circled one set of data with a red marker, and then he's kind of making a frowny face as he's approaching it, as like he's not liking what he's seeing. Is this potentially a mist? Because we know that sometime in the next couple of minutes or hour or so that he scrawled, "We're all dead." Is this a potential misdirect where this is just like a cynical scientist who is looking at global warming and like seeing a new conclusion? It's like, "Oh, yeah, we're just so fucking boned." Or yeah, is this more "She is awake" kind of crazy scrawling?
I'll push back. We don't know that he actually wrote "We're all dead."
True.
We know that somebody wrote it.
Yes.
So I think that's an interesting question, right? If you want to like tie it to the environment stuff, yeah.
And there's three.
Might look at some data points and say we're fucked.
There's like three more figures that were circled in red. He had only circled, I think, one. And so there's more. That's almost like he was making. That was the other thing I wanted to point out there. But continue.
And there's something at the bottom of that board too, talking about separating out different isotopes, and the lighter ones will preferentially rise and the heavy ones will sink. I don't know if that ties into the case at all, but yeah, so I immediately look at this and saying, are they playing some kind of, you know, AR sort of game with us, you know, some online, like, okay, look at these coordinates, because there's a latitude and a longitude there. There are some other
apparently it's an impossible. Did you see that's an impossible coordinates?
Oh, no, I didn't.
Because it gives the minutes in as like 65, and you can't have more than 60 minutes in a coordinate.
Gotcha.
So these are literally invalid coordinates. That might be the equivalent of putting a 555 in a phone number, just so, like, you know, because if you put a real G, you're going to have someone punch it in, and then they're going to be like, "Oh, what's here?" And it might be a way just to fictionalize it.
Yeah. I could definitely see, you know, research scientists being like, "Yeah, we're screwed because of climate change." But it could also be, "Well, we unleashed something that is terrifying and we're screwed."
100%.
They could have detected some new data points at some point during that conversation. Maybe he's working on old ones. Maybe he lied about it. This is new data. He just didn't want this other guy working on it with him. And he determined that, oops, the new data says the mining facility just, you know, released a bunch of toxic gas, and we all at this facility are dead. We all up here in Ennis are dead. A lot of possibilities.
And then we're going to have the bridge that launches us into the second arm of the investigation, which they find this native woman's tongue, or at least Jodie Foster's character Liz surmises that, because it has grooves worn in from the constant licking of the ends of threads that repair fishing nets. I did some research, and I could not find any instance of tongued grooves or grooved tongues. But I guess it's plausible, you know? It's certainly, certainly plausible.
Yeah, I mean, I buy it. I think you get repetitive stress injuries that damage your muscles and shit. Why couldn't it happen to, you know, the tissue?
I would think so too. And there's all kinds of, like, you know, and people's, like, you can tell by looking at people, like, how callous their hands are, you know, what kind of work they do. It doesn't seem implausible. So this is going to, like I said, this is going to springboard us into the other possibly connected investigation of this missing Native activist who was protesting the mines. Did they ever say what kind of mine it is? Is this like a cold mine? I noticed it was called Silver Sky. Is it like a silver mine?
I don't know. I don't know if they said.
We're introduced to it by her brother, who Officer Navarro goes to talk about or talk with to try to see if, you know, she's missed, you know, this tongue showed up and it's got her kind of turning over things in her mind. We find out that doesn't seem particularly happy to see her either.
No.
Because it turns out that the Anne kind of was like off on her own island. A lot of the town folk opposed her because they saw the mine as essentially propping up the whole town. If the mine dies, they do. You know, the mining folk didn't like her. She was struggling with she's fighting with her family. So we didn't find much out of that. Then Peter, it turns out that they had files on this missing woman, and the police department got flooded at some point, and Hank, Pete's dad, has made off with these files, and the Anne files are part of it. This is a mystery that I don't know how to solve. Why Liz, who is, I think, the chief of police, got 4 stars on her collar, why can't she just go to Hank and be like, give me these files, you fucker. These are not your files.
I think she could. I think she has the authority to do that. Why won't she is the question, right?
It's got to be some kind of pride power struggle. Like, it seems like she's all... Mm-hmm. Just from what I can tell, it seems like they have very different ideas of how to do things when it comes to police work. You know, he's wanting to let the drunk drivers out of the drunk tank before they even sober up. He's mm-hmm. not really wanting to spend too much time investigating this research station. He's kind of dismissing her. There's some kind of power struggle, and for whatever reason, she'd prefer to use Peter, his son, to get the things that she want rather than ask herself. There's also, like, someone's challenged me on the instant talk about, like, why do you think that they're a couple? The reason I think they're a couple is because, you know, all the preview stuff that I read and research mentioned that they had a former relationship. But even without that, I thought that pretty much screamed off of the screen, you know, that these feel like people who had an intimate relationship that went sour, and now they kind of hate each other, but they have to work with each other.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't think there's anything specific I can point to say that this makes it definitive, but it's a vibe I'm getting from them.
The way she's commenting on his domestication.
Uh-huh.
You're not the kind of dad that made sandwiches. You don't know your way around a laundry room. Like, that'd be a wild thing for your chief of police to say, you know, if she hasn't picked up your dirty, smelly socks off her bedroom floor, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think you're right. There's some relationship there. I'm super curious about this whole part of the episode, and it's one of the least talked about parts of the episode from what I've seen.
No one I could find discussing why this power struggle is happening.
This and Hank's potential involvement in things. I don't see a lot of discussion about that either, maybe because we just don't have a ton of information
about it. I did see
a
decent number of people saying, Hank's like, it's not just he's disinterested in the police work, he's actually trying to run cover.
Well, there are a lot of ways that can go. A lot of reasons
why
he could be doing
it. Can you break that? Because, like, I didn't. The one thing that people were pointing to is him texting as they're exiting the Salal building. And I thought that was just him making final details with his girlfriend to pick her up from the, you know, like, it seemed like the reason he's preoccupied is because he's about to welcome his Russian bride, mail order bride, into the States, right? She's about to...
Yeah, I think there are a lot of plausible...
About to row over the Bering Straits to see him, you know?
Sure. I think there are a lot of plausible things he could be doing there. And one of them is just, you know, he's distracted by this thing that he's excited about with his Russian mail order bride. It could also be that he's deeply connected to the Anne K murder, and he's texting people to say, this shit's back on, they found the tongue, you know,
another,
like,
tongue,
we need to move, guys.
We thought we were clever and we hid that tongue at the bottom of an ice core sample. But they looked at the old data. No one thought they'd look at the old data.
Yeah, We hit it where the at some unnatural hour of latitude.
Yeah, right.
They cracked. Had it. He let it go. I don't get it.
They cracked. They found the watch with the 67th minute.
So there are a lot of plausible reasons he could be texting there. The thing that makes it, I don't know. I'm not sure if it's fishy yet. I think at bare minimum, this guy is incompetent. I think that's one thing they're kind of like trying to show us, is he's like a guy who doesn't take his work nearly as seriously as Liz does. And I think you can sort of piece it together that he was in Liz's position. He was maybe the chief up there when Navarro was working the Ann K case, because later on they say that he's the one that took the Navarro off the case.
I think I'm with you. I thought, and of course I've only seen this like 2.5 times, I thought that there might be room to interpret that as I think the Christopher Eccleston figure,
Connolly,
as the one taking the him off or her off the case, because they were kind of vague about the when they're using those pronouns about he. Huh. I'm not even sure I have concrete evidence for the vagueness. It's just that's the kind of I thought it was a little being fast and loose with it.
It's possible, but my interpretation right now, my reading is that Hank was the chief. Hank was the guy in charge.
Yeah,
when that case was going on. So, you know, there's possibilities here, right? There's sure. a possibility. He's an incompetent cop who couldn't get that case solved because of his incompetence. And now he realizes, oops, I fucked a lot of stuff up during that investigation, and I don't want people to find out, so I can't give them the files. The other possibility is he is deeply involved in it. He maybe contributed to or covered up the murder knowingly. And now he's trying to cover up that fact. The third possibility is he's just kind of a lazy.
Yeah.
He's disinterested in solving the case, and so he's not getting the files to her in time, and like he's just kind of a general goofball. That's another possibility.
I wonder, is there like she makes a statement to kind of like backs up one of your assertions there, that like she says Innes killed this woman. That's mm-hmm. why it'll never be solved. And I think what she means that is like the vast majority of people who live in Innes is kind of like, yeah, that's about right.
Yeah.
And maybe she shouldn't been stabbed 30 times, but like we're, you know, we kind of support silencing her and taking her off the board.
Mm-hmm. Because of her activist roots, that kind of stuff.
That could be like, honestly, Hank, like could be maliciously negligent, or he could just be like, oh, you know, fuck. Mm-hmm. She fucked around and she found out. So the facts of, so we get the facts of the case when Peter drops off the case files. He kind of blackmails Liz into telling her the details, and she says that Navarro was the first person on the scene. They found her murdered in a cargo container. She was stabbed 32 times with a sharp object that left star-shaped wounds. She was missing her tongue. The murder weapon was never found. She was in the community a midwife, an activist, a protester. She drove the mine folks nuts, and from management down to the workers. And apparently Navarro got so obsessed. It's so interesting how Liz's attitude about this, like she's almost rolling her eyes and like, ah, oh, can you believe this woman getting obsessed about tracking down women, the people that are doing violence against women. But she got obsessed with this case and when her investigation went nowhere, started bugging what Liz describes as mine people, including showing up at a Kate McKittrick's house.
Yeah.
I don't know who this Kate McKittrick is, but I'm guessing she's got to be like one of the owners or the CEOs or someone high up that, Navarro started demanding answers from. And that's when your dad had when she says Pete's dad. Yeah, you're right. She said your dad had to take her off the case. That doesn't mean he's the chief of police. It just means he would be Navarro's superior.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's where I'm like, oh, I'm not sure if that means he's the chief. It just means.
Yeah, Connolly could be above him. There could be somebody else we don't know yet. Yeah.
Although when they were looking at that picture, I got to say that like my interpretation of that is like her and Christopher Eccleston's character was standing at the extreme outside. To me, that says that they were kind of outsiders. And I think the guy standing in the middle is kind of blurred. I think that was Hank. So I actually think you're right. I think Hank is the chief, was the chief of police.
Yeah, there's nothing like super conclusive, but it's likely.
What political machinations led to them having a love affair? And at the end of it, she is going to be the chief of police and he's reporting to her.
Yeah, him getting busted down. I don't know, man. Negligence is my only thought. Like, it just came out that, yeah, this guy's not a good chief.
But he's still a police officer. I guess that checks out. Like, okay, he's too incompetent to be the chief. But, yeah, you know, you can scrape caribou off the road or whatever.
Sure, yeah. Need people to do those jobs.
So, yeah. So that takes care of those two aspects. There's only one other of the central mystery, and that's Rose Agonow, which I referred to as Harry Potter's aunt throughout the take.
Do you want to talk about maybe some of the star-shaped wounds around this? Because with the Anne Kay killing, that was interesting to me for its symbology there and its connection to the She's Awake stuff. Specifically this polar bear, right, that has this star-shaped wound over its eye and shows up when weird things are happening and the radio perhaps is saying she's awake. There seems to be some connection to she's awake in the Anne Kay situation.
There's three instances of someone saying she's awake. One is the guy who says it in the research station as he's convulsing. One is the little boy says it to, I forget his name. We'll get to that when
Holden.
We get to Holden. Says it to her in her dreams, I guess, or as a ghost whispering into her ear. And the third is, when Navarro is driving around late at night talking to someone who's connected with the old Anne Kay case, she starts to get the radio disturbances, and then, she hears it somehow.
Somehow. Or we hear it? I'm not even clear that she hears it. We hear it, definitely.
And two of those are connected tightly to a polar bear. When Liz hears it, she looks down, there's a polar bear stuffy missing an eye. I think that's real.
Yeah, that's a real stuffed animal, I think.
And then Navarro sees a real polar bear with a missing eye in the same location as a toy had one. So that's wild.
Yeah.
So anyway, Rose is out there gutting a wolf like you do. Don't know why you'd butcher a wolf, I guess for its pelt. But she's butchering it, and the wolf seems to like start as if it's still alive, which she's like, that's fucking weird. And she looks off in the middle distance, and this guy named Travis shows up. He's not wearing a coat, no hat, no gloves, no shoes.
Socks, no shoes, yeah.
Barefoot on the Alaskan tundra. This is the guy who I thought was Christopher Eccleston in the Instant Take podcast, because I think he looks like Christopher Eccleston with wild hair, but he's not. Then Rose is back, so she has one encounter with him. She's then doing her dishes later that night when Travis comes calling again. This time she puts on her coat and decides to follow where he's going. And she follows him out to a flat spot with her flashlight, where he starts doing what I can only describe as interpretive dance. He's waving like a frond of seaweed in the ocean.
I think of the scene in Big Lebowski where his neighbor... His landlord does the interpretive dance.
Yeah, he's making some swirl, admittedly spiral shaped gestures. Okay.
okay.
And he ends with this by pointing over the horizon, and she follows that. And the next thing we know, she's alerted the police forces, who are showing up with helicopters. And Navarro asked how she found them, and she says, Travis showed me. And she assures people, I know he's dead. We find out Travis is dead. And then we see, again, I'm not sure if these are eight scientists. We see three frozen scientist heads.
So far.
One I thought was interesting. It's clearly visibly naked from the shoulders up. So possibly all these scientists naked. And they all seem to be screaming in agony or terror. Some people said they were frozen like a swirling position. I don't know what from swirl. They look like dudes frozen in an ice cube for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's all I'm prepared to say about that, too.
I'm not even sure. Would you say they're reclining? Would you say they're like...
It seems like they're recoiling from something, maybe. Or one of them is attacking another,
but
almost?
Are they laying down? Like, I'm thinking they could be frozen straight up and down in the, like some kind of flash frozen situation. Because whatever happened to them had to be very quick.
Yes.
Because if they died and their faces went slack, these people look like they're dying in agony or fear.
Yep. Got their hands up as if they're...
Yeah, defensive.
One of them has
yeah.
hands up in a defensive posture. Yeah, it's...
Yeah.
It's curious. This is exciting. I like this as a cliffhanger.
Maybe this is another detached interlude, because it's not... I think it's direct related to these cases, but it's more of the inspiration. I want to talk about the what seems to be a big thing this season, which is the disappearance of Native and Indigenous women.
Okay.
We talked about in the preview podcast that, you know, the person who plays Navarro, Kaylee Reese, is very involved in the missing and murdered Indigenous women charity work. The previous show that she did, was it Catch the Right Ones, I think, was all about a woman investigating her sister, missing sister. And there's some shocking statistics. I first became aware of this when, cause it's something that's frequently brought up in the Reservation Dog show that we like, but the statistics are wild. The homicide rate for Indigenous women in Canada is 6 times higher than all other women. And despite being 4% of the population, they accounted for 16% of all women murdered in Canada.
Wow.
Which is in the last decade, which is another wild statistic. And the U.S., it's not much better. A Native woman in the United States is twice as likely to experience violence in their lifetimes compared to non-Native women. And I think some people could have like a knee-jerk response of like, oh, man, Native men don't treat their women very well. But 67% of the perpetrators in the United States against Indigenous women are non-Indigenous. So it's violence coming from outside the community in an outsized proportion. And the other thing you find out when you look into this is like, my God, this is insane. Why isn't things being done, or why aren't people looking into this? And you keep coming back to the conclusion. It's like people just don't fucking care. You know, like it's one of the things that makes this to people that's involved in these communities despair is that it's very hard to get any kind of like attention. And I feel like that's maybe starting to change, because I think of like the last year, Reservation Dogs, Killers of the Flower Moon, this show, Bam Bam Bam, pretty big cultural milestones kind of hammering on this. So maybe they'll get some traction now. But yeah, it's a real epidemic, and I there's also equally horrifying trafficking statistics as well. So, it's a real problem, and Issa Lopez is trying to shine a light on it. And like I said, Kaylee Reese seems to definitely care a lot about the issue.
Yeah.
I kind of want to talk about the credit sequence.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, we talked about a little bit of this. I think it's, I like it. I think the Billie Eilish song is really catchy, and it's kind of like a really creepy and detuned, and you know,
it has an underwater sort of frozen sound to it, which I think fits
it
well with the song.
Does have a little bit of an underwater kind of sound to it. And the way she's talking about, you know, why are you afraid of me? Why are you run from me? Where do we go? When we're asleep, where do we go? You know, when we're unconscious. Kind of creepy. I like it. And the imagery, you've got, you know, some ice road trucking. It's just lots of scenes of the frozen highway. I noticed that some of those scenes had like these giant arches over it, which I think are whale bones.
Oh, okay.
There's a full bathtub that's frozen. I can't imagine what that's about. A rocking chair with the polar bear, both stuffed and real variety. Bloody clothes on laundry lines. Like, you know, the circular, like compact laundry lines that you see sometimes. Animal skulls interspersed with ice cores. A cemetery with a bunch of grave markers. Like you mentioned, the protest posters. Police SUVs, looks like age or Officer Navarro and Danvers drowning. An orange peel suspended in frozen water. Godfather reference?
That's where my mind goes immediately with oranges. Yeah. I don't know.
Dead body parts, like a dead foot discolored foot, people frozen in ice, ice tunnels. It's a very dreamlike quality to the imagery. I thought it was pretty affecting.
And also very clue heavy from what I understand. I read an interview with Issa Lopez where she was talking about how they kind of just went wild with the clues in that intro.
Oh, really?
They just had fun with it. Yeah. So there might be a lot of stuff that we haven't figured out yet that's in this episode and in that intro.
Got five whole episodes to go, but like, yeah, and obviously mm-hmm. there's a lot of hits on that, but it's like, is it the type of clue that only makes sense in the context of full season? Or...
Yeah, like a frozen bathtub. What the hell does that have to do with anything we saw in this episode?
Exactly.
You're listening to The World We Deserve. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. We're back with more of The World We Deserve.
So I thought that the other major topics could be the lead investigators themselves, and I'd like to start with Liz Danvers.
Okay.
I thought it's interesting, and I'm wondering, because, like, you know, we just got done with Christmas. I love Christmas. I love Christmas episodes. There's lots of Christmas imagery. You know, we're just a few days before Christmas. The police department's all decorated. People are talking about kids and Santa Claus and where they're going to get pictures of the Santa Claus. Liz seems like it's important to her that she provides some kind of like classic good old fashioned Christmas to her adopted stepdaughter, Leah.
Maybe out of guilt. It almost feels like I'm never really her mother. I need to do something nice.
Do you think that, or is this like, or is it like that's something she's always done? I didn't get any guilt out of it. That's like something that I think the girl Leah said, that, like, you know, you don't have to be my mom. My dad, I don't think my dad would have expected it from you.
Yeah, it was something about the placement of it. After, you know, she's talking with her daughter, and the daughter's saying, like, you don't even give a shit, and all this stuff, I just look at that and I say, this is a woman who's more concerned with her job than she is with her daughter, with being a mother. So that's where I'm coming from. It's something about the vibe of their relationship.
It could be just teen, because, like, you know, there's also, it could just be, you know, a teenager who's like doesn't care about the big Christmas celebrations anymore, and the stepmom trying to keep it going. And I can kind of relate to kids aging out of the old Christmas stuff, but yeah, I don't know. I was wondering, is that just some kind of, where's the guilt coming from? Is it coming from the daughter observing, like, the behavior of her stepmom? Is it coming from, like, a real place of kind of, like, yeah, resentment that Liz has, that she's stuck with these people out of some sense of guilt or responsibility? Because I kind of felt like that's one of the reasons she's taken Pete under her wing, is that she, and maybe she's missing a child of her own, that Colton character is like, was her child that she lost, and she's then trying to find other children that she can care for amongst her former lovers.
Because
that's the other speculation I'm making, is that she was in some sort of loving relationship with Leah's father.
Yeah, I haven't made that jump yet. I'd love to hear more about why you think that is.
Because I'm running wild to speculation.
Of course.
I want to run with you.
Take my hand. Let's do this.
So why do we think she had the emotional reaction to the Beatles? Because that was what's playing when the drunk driving incident happened. Why would she have an intense relate? If she's just a cop going to a drunk driving scene and being like, oh man, dad, oh, young daughter, that's sad. That's one thing. But to, like, take it personal to where,
10
years later,
you
have to hunt it down and kill it, that tells me that there was, it's more than just a girl. There was some sort of relationship.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That reaction.
Not exactly QED, but I'm getting there. I feel like I got 2/3 of the equation anyway.
Well, my read on Liz is not somebody who's going out seeking relationships with people. And I don't know if this is a change that happened after some disastrous thing where she lost perhaps her lover and son, not the same person, by the way, or if this is something that has always been part of her personality. But she seems to not be very good at parenting, and B, not seeking it out, like doing it almost reluctantly. That's the vibe I'm getting from her.
But it's
weird because of the Pete stuff too. So
I'm making a lot of wild swings, but like I got this feeling that like maybe she is pretty quick to jump into relationships, jump in and out of them. Because I look at a woman who in this small town has at least had 3 relationships. If this Colton is a child of her, she had a relationship with his father. She had a relationship with Leah's father. She had a relationship with Pete's father. And I think she's pretty, like, I also got the idea that she is an outsider. Like, she got transferred here. I don't know where I got that in surmisal. Maybe because she just feels like she's better than everybody around here. But, like, yeah.
Well,
like
that flashback that we see of somebody's feet as she's walking across the pavement to get to the drunk driver, to Stacy, that does not look like it happened in this town.
It doesn't, but also, like, Alaska goes through a whole summer.
Oh, I know. I'm not saying because it's grass. I'm saying because it's, like, a curb. There's, like,
I definitely
a curb, and, like,
it
looks
suburban.
More developed than this extremely remote research mining town. Yeah.
No, I feel you. I was one of the devil's advocate because I got that same feeling. This isn't, even though I know Alaska has a summer and it can be green and beautiful, this felt like lush suburban sidewalk. Yeah. Front lawn type of situations.
Much
I don't
more
think
manicured
you get
than
Innes.
You care to be at Innes, I would think.
Yeah. So I think we're simpatico. But like the idea that she came to this community and kind of like maybe was trying to find whatever she was missing. I wonder if there's been multiple drunk driving incidents. Like, did her son get killed in a drunk driving incident?
Twice,
and then is
least.
That why she took Leah in? Because maybe she didn't have a relationship with her father. It's just, I had a child killed by a drunk driver. Here's a child orphaned by a drunk driver.
Yeah.
There's room in my heart. There's room in my home.
Wow. And then Stacy's done it twice. Maybe the she that everybody's saying she's awake is Stacy.
Surely Stacy hasn't killed anybody.
I don't think so, no.
Because, like, I think the town, there would be a little bit different tone to, oh, is that Stacy fucking Chalmers than there is if she's just a... Why do I think it's so funny when Jodie Foster bullies this woman?
I don't know, but I'm with you. Because she's clearly a menace, right? Like, she's drunk driving, risking killing people, if not actually killing people. She's right. being as obnoxious as she possibly can in that prison cell or in that jail cell.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something about her. You don't... Yeah, I don't know. I find it hilarious, too. I really love it.
Yeah, because, like, I guess it always bothers me when some person has egregious behavior and they're just so pathetic and sniveling about it. It's like... No, you can't make me feel bad for being angry at you just because you're pathetic. You're behaving in an outrageous fashion. Out here driving drunk. I don't care how blubbery and soft. Get the fuck up and take this bullying. I need to let a little bit of my annoyance and anger out. Okay. She's just so the way Liz just stands her up and, like, shut the fuck up, turns around, cuffs her. She's just over it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And again, the neighbors, like, yanking open the windows. That fucking Stacy Chalmers again. Just no parking meter is safe in this town from her.
Mm-hmm.
What do we think is going? Because, like, at first I was like, what are they trying to tell me about Leah with the ages and everything? As far as I can tell, she is like 16 years old. She goes to high school with this girl that she's in an intimate relationship, and they filmed a little bit of underage porno. Hey, look, that's not good, kids. You shouldn't trade, because, like, if this gets in the hands of the authorities, it will be considered child porn, and it will be a whole big fucking deal.
I don't know if they were making the point that it's not actually child porn or something, because the age of consent is 16 in Alaska, and so the distinction between 15 and 16 might be important. I don't know.
But it might be, but, like,
more, it could also be a kid just, like, you know, being petulant and saying, oh, she's not 15, she's 16, mom.
But I thought it was weird, because at first I was like, oh my god, is this woman 20? You know, like, but I know, sure, I don't, I don't think that's the case. I think it's all,
yeah,
they're all the same age. It was all consenting. It's just foolish. It's foolish teenage behavior, but something that a lot of kids do.
That's the thing. They don't think about it, right? And right. Man, the way she frames it is like, oh yeah, all the legal angles are covered, or all the criminal angles are covered, mom. When they're talking about it, I'm like, you're missing the point. What your mom is saying is there are unforeseen angles for this to come to the attention of the community, and then you will be forever branded a particular type of person. And the kids
and
just don't think about those possibilities.
You can't even conceive of your life, let alone what the impacts. And but also, there's
right.
the immortal teenage response, which is YOLO, man. Like, it's so funny that, because I'm not going through this particular thing, but the whole, like, yeah, sometimes kids just have to, they got to make their own mistakes. Like, you want them to be like, why can't you learn from all my mistakes and all the things I'm teaching you? But then you think as yourself as a child, does that, you know, maybe you did a little bit better or worse, but no one learned everything that they needed to just by listening. Okay. You know?
Absolutely not. Yeah.
So it is infuriating, but it is also a fact of life.
It felt like a very real conversation. I liked it.
Yeah, I could. Yeah. And even the daughter trying to have a conversation with her about the drunk driving angle of it and their shared trauma, which is where I started thinking, like, OK, this thing that Jodie Foster went through is probably predates her, and it's something that they have a shared bond with, but it's not the actual same trauma that bonded them. It's just a similar one.
Yeah, potentially. Yeah.
Yeah, she also, that's the other thing, is like the whole her and Hank being in a relationship, the way she talks mad shit about Stacy Chalmers blowing him and about his Russian bride and all that stuff is, but also it's like, I it makes me think it's all true, because, like, when she said the Russian bride, I thought that was going to be a joke, but it doesn't seem like it's a joke.
No, it's real.
He's flying in a woman from Vladivostok to get married over Christmas, like some kind of demented Hallmark movie. Like,
yeah,
a Russian
bride
for Christmas.
He knows so little about this woman that his grand gesture is to paint a room the color she likes. It's
blue, yeah.
But not like a specific blue. It's not like they've traded texts and she said, oh yeah, I love this blue. He's just like guessing at the blue. He barely knows this woman.
So I know Pete's not direct, but it's just such a minor scene that I shoved it under Liz's scene. He's got a wife, a Native American wife, who is exposing
you think this
their
is a
son.
Minor scene?
I mean, it's just like, yeah, like it's not a minor scene, but it's like 3 minutes out of the runtime. It's the only time we actually see Pete on his own, with his family. But yeah, he's got. I'm not sure if they're married, but they're definitely in a relationship where they're co-parenting this adorable little boy named Darwin, and she's exposing him to Native myths and legends, including apparently this horrifying blue woman with blood dripping out of her eyes and hands.
If I say the name Sedna to you, does that mean anything?
It's the name of an asteroid or a comet, but it's also apparently a local water deity.
This is kind of like a
mermaid looking goddess.
In Inuit mythology, this is the goddess of the sea and marine life, I guess. Marine animals. And the whole story around her, the mythology here is that there are a lot of different stories about it in various regional mythologies, mm-hmm. but they all have kind of in common one thing, which is that her father, who was the creator of all life, took her out to the sea in a kayak, and something startled him, made him think that she was the cause of some of the problems, whether it was a storm that came in or whether it was the gods were angry at her for something, threw her overboard. She clung to the side, and in order to get her off of the ship, he had to cut her fingers off.
Mm.
And so this image that you see here is almost certainly Sedna. When you say, okay, this Inuit woman has been putting mythological stories into this kid's head, and that's what he's upset about. That's why her hands are bleeding. And if you look, also, the fingers are separated from the hands. You got star-shaped wounds on the eyes, which ties back to the Anne Kay stuff. But this, I think, is interesting in a sort of like... There are other ties to it as well. Like if you look at the crab processing facility, the woman who has been abused by this man is missing a couple fingers in a shot, and they address it
right,
explicitly.
It's part of
the
job.
In the thing.
Yeah. Interesting. I like that.
And you know, being the goddess of the sea and marine life, and these environmental concerns all kind of tie in too. So that kind of hints at maybe it's an environmental pollution or contamination sort of thing that we're dealing with.
Also, you know how like they say that like there's these worldwide myths about floods, you know, like the story of Gilgamesh and Noah, and it all points back to like there might be some primordial trauma in Mesopotamia, like a like not a global flood, but a regional flood that's so traumatic it's embedded in all the world's cultures. You think in terms of Eve and Pandora, and I guess Sedna, where all the world's problems are introduced by women. Do you think that also points to some kind of universal truth about women being the root cause of all of our problems? I mean,
it just
stands to reason if they're, anyway.
No, but it's definitely a theme that the show is playing with, right? Like, what is the animosity toward women, especially this particular type of woman, this Native woman?
Yeah. Why do you want to shut them up?
Yeah.
And there's also like some friction there between the not just the sharing Native stories and all that kind of playful white and merry white boy stuff, but she also seems to be really upset with how obsessed he is with this job and how much asks Danvers is making of him.
Yeah, and how he kind of can't say no. The other thing about the Sedna stuff I think is interesting is she's awake, right? I mean, this is the goddess of the sea and marine life, so I could see this being a sort of local vibe that she's awake might mean Sedna is awake. And typically what happens in these myths with Sedna is when she gets angered, or perhaps when she's awakened in a certain point of view, a shaman has to go out and brush her hair for her because she can't do it herself. She has no fingers. So there's some appeasing that needs to happen of this angered, vengeful spirit. So this could be the less literal term of like she's awake, right?
I like it. We saw the photo that Pete uses as cover when his dad, you know, he's over there. Says, hey, I said I'd show Darwin an old picture of me. So I want to go through all your stuff. And the dad's like, all right. But when he comes in there, he kind of catches his son doing something weird at the window. He's like, so I think he's suspicious. And he says, what did you, I want to see what you took. And he shows him a picture of, I think, him and his mom. Which implies another tragedy that has befallen a woman, right? Because it feels like she's out of the picture more than just they got divorced, you know? Yeah. I thought that was interesting. Right. Like, there's all this mysterious, you know, bad disappearances connected to women. And, we also talked about Liz sleeping and wakes up. That's a really creepy scene. I thought this was a very Issa Lopez scene where the child's hand, like, touches her shoulder. And she wakes up almost like it's actually there.
Yeah. But see, doesn't seem bothered by it either. It seems like this might be a recurring thing for her.
Yeah.
A familiar sort of experience, because she doesn't recoil like you might if a hand
child
suddenly
even
touched you.
Her dead child, it's like, I don't think she takes it as a creepy thing. It's more of a, this is happening quite a bit. What do you think she keeps? Does she sleep with the one-eyed polar bear to kind of remind, is that her son?
I think this is an artifact, of her relationship with her son. Yeah.
I would say that would start to be a little bit more evidence that this is a clear paranormal thing going on, because I don't know how the hell Navarro would hallucinate a polar bear with a star-shaped eye wound that matches this little boy's polar bear stuffy with a missing eye. Anytime you see shared delusions, that's when it's like, oh, this isn't just a chemical in the water. This is something happening.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just night country, it's bear country too. You've got polar
can't
bears
stop
up there, so.
Right.
I don't know. Could be a coincidence, but who knows?
So we also have that scene of Liz going, doing her investigation with the Carcosa spiral.
Oh, and yeah. I bet there's just a treasure trove of stuff in here if you know what to look for. I bet so many of these photos are showing us just big clues we don't understand yet.
And it feels very early Lost, because especially with the polar bear, but like all these random case studies of Alaskan biodiversity and the scientists' faces and the bases and all that stuff. And she then gets the idea of like, she's kind of resisting, but she keeps looking at that ANK box, and she's like, fuck it. She gets it out and starts looking for, and what do you know? She finds a potential match of the coat. This early, I feel like this has got to be a misdirect, that if they had a relationship, it was like a lover type relationship, and that he's probably not directly connected to her death, but like the show definitely wants you to think he is, especially with him being perhaps a lone survivor of this event.
Perhaps, yeah.
As you mentioned, whoever is running around the base appears to be wearing that jacket.
Seemingly. I think this also shows that like there was stuff to follow up on that Hank just didn't do when this case was fresh. Where is Anne's jacket? You know, we have photos of her wearing this coat. Mm-hmm. Where did that coat go? Because she wasn't found with it. So
no, she wasn't found wearing a coat, which might imply that. Yeah.
So where did that coat go? Who has it? You know, if they don't find it in her house, well, someone who was around her must have had it. And, you know, he couldn't have like, maybe known where it was, but he doesn't seem to have even investigated where it was.
So we're gonna have this final scene featuring Liz. They'll probably transition us to the next topic of the other detective. Is she shows up to the station, perhaps, you know, awaken, like a little intuition waking up the middle of the night with her kid waking her up, and she finds Navarro already there, accuses her of trespassing because this ain't her business, warns her that this could sink, you know, this case sunk her once, could sink her again. And there's an interesting thing where it's like there's a bunch of bitterness and resentment on both sides, where Navarro thinks that the Ennis Police Department in particular, and Liz is kind of caught up in this, that they're sandbagging or not taking the the thing seriously. And Liz says, "No, wait a minute. I wasn't even here when you got taken off the case. And you're just mad that you didn't clear it because you were the one that was here and you couldn't get the shit done and you flamed out." So it's like,
yeah.
Yeah.
And then her response is, exactly. Because that was her point. I can't let this go. This
right,
is personal to me.
I did
right?
let it down. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So Liz yeah. is defensive because she thinks this is, she's reflecting this at her, where it's really mm-hmm. this is, no, she understands, no, I'm upset with myself. I did fail my, yeah. you know, quote unquote sister here. And she also talks about, like, you weren't there. Like, you literally, the visceral reaction of seeing this woman's body and how they violated it and the anger and the hate is something that, like, stuck in her craw, too. Because I imagine it is, mm-hmm. like, a crazy thing to find a person butchered like that.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, maybe we can transition to our next police officer. Let's talk about Evangeline Navarro.
Okay.
We first see her responding to a crab packing plant. Did you notice the name of this place?
This is Blue King.
Blue King. How many other colors of king will we get in the True Detective universe?
Well, if you mix yellow and blue, you get green. So we need the Green King.
The exact shade of seafoam blue that that Hank paints on his bedroom for his.
All right, so
bride.
Hank's
no,
the, blue,
yeah.
the Blue King.
Yeah.
He's the
he
murderer.
He is the
yeah.
Blue King.
Yeah.
Holy shit. Solved it in the first episode.
I mean, Hank's definitely more involved than we know currently, but to say he's the Blue, a.k.a. Yellow King, I don't know, man.
I thought it was interesting how, because I'm still think this is an interesting scenario, an interesting a way to open this, where Navarro comes in and first she's kind of interrogating the women about why did they, but then she switches to kind of like, you know, deciding that the guy is an asshole. I'm not sure why when she walked in on a guy who's unconscious on the ground and there's two women, one of them with a black eye and the other comforting, why she decided that the women are but I guess that's what happened. The plant manager wanted those two to be arrested for assault.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because he's this dude's best friend. Like, what's wrong with this Maybe. Asshole that he, this guy came in drunk and belligerent to lay hands on his ex who's broken up with him and moved out with him. And mm-hmm. this old native woman clocks him with a crab bucket. And she's mm-hmm. like, this guy's got to go.
Yeah. This guy clearly is biased.
The hostility towards
out.
The women. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a hostile. He's definitely hostile toward them. But he seems hostile toward everyone. And this is yeah. not getting him off the hook here. I'm just observing his character. He seems hostile because he runs this plant and it's not going well. He talks about every year the crabs get fewer and fewer. The meat diminishes. He can't hit his quotas, that kind of stuff. You know, and you can tie that back to the environmental stuff here. But yeah, his attitude is, I wasn't getting like, this is my best friend and I'm trying to protect him. I was getting more like, this guy, well, he doesn't work at the plant, does he? He doesn't work at the plant.
Oh, no, he doesn't. He doesn't.
So never mind. I was getting the vibe of like, well, he's our best crab processing guy.
Best
Let's
crab
get
guy.
Him back on the line.
And a lady with three fingers no. gets him hurt? No, I can't have. Yeah.
Right. But no, that's not it. So, yeah, he just seems like he's a sexist asshole.
I like how easily Navarro handled him. Of course, you know, she's obviously a very strong woman and mm-hmm. he's also drunk, but in his indignation that she's taking a phone call while she's subduing him.
Yeah.
That was pretty funny. But yeah, like this woman's lost two fucking, she doesn't even look that old. She's like, what, in her mid 30s, maybe early 30s. And
maybe,
she's already
yeah.
missing two fingers on her right arm. Damn.
Mm-hmm.
So next, she goes to her to Annie's brother, after you know, to kind of reopen this investigation, and he's got an interesting, you know, like it seems like he thought that his sister fucked around and found out, but now he sees like, oh, the water's gone to shit. It's not safe to drink as of 3 days ago, and some of the things that she was prophesying in terms of water quality and the mine and all that might be coming true. So he's got like mixed feelings about it, but at the time it seems like he kind of was like content to let sleeping dogs lie.
Yeah.
Do you think he has anything to do with the, like, does he know who killed us? I mean, obviously I don't think he said murder my sister. I'm cool with that. But like, if the town of Innis truly murdered her.
Yeah.
Maybe he just a little bit like, hey, I'm not going to move here from here. And there's nothing else that's going to fix this. Like, bringing the people to, like, who do you bring to justice if a town killed a person?
Right, right. It's possible he knows something or is withholding something that might connect somebody to Anne. There's a conspicuous shot in this episode that I want to talk about when Navarro goes to first talk to him and he's coming out of the coal mine or whatever mine it is. Mm-hmm. They linger on some dude.
I saw that too.
Just kind of next to Ryan here. And he seems very concerned with Navarro talking to Ryan.
Agreed.
Or highly interested in a somewhat negative way.
He's put out.
He knows something.
He's definitely got why the fuck is she here? And I do wonder. Yeah. That's it. I do wonder if he know. Like, again, I don't think her brother killed her, but I think he probably knows who did. And I bet this guy knows that he knows.
If I want to give him the benefit of the doubt, I'm saying he's concerned because this is clearly going to reopen some old wound that his buddy here has just barely started healing from.
Yeah, and that could be it too.
He could be just genuinely concerned for his buddy's well-being, but I didn't get that vibe from him.
Especially a six-year-old murder, would you bing that hard with a cop just standing to talk to your buddy? Or like, it almost like, right. Is the idea that he knows the tongue is out in the wild recently?
Maybe.
Because why would you... Yeah, unless he's just a concerned friend, it's like, oh my God, this guy is just now sleeping at night and this fucking cop is showing up again with a new lead. Maybe it's that, but like also...
Yeah, I don't like this guy.
Yeah, why would he hit that hard 6 years later? I don't know. That's I clocked the same thing, though. He also asked if... I guess they're really estranged at the end that they had barely spoken leading up to her death, but then he asked her if she believes in God. And she starts to explain about an experience she had in her last tour of duty. And we're on the battlefield, and she runs up this woman who's missing half of her head. Something's blown out half of her skull, and she whispers something to her. Some people wondered if she is saying something about her son, but it's subtitled in this. When I watched it again, she's saying, listen.
Yeah.
But her knowledge of the existence of God has not brought her any comfort or feeling of less loneliness, because she mentions God's alone too. It's interesting.
Thing. Yeah, which is pretty fucking metal. I love that statement.
Any thoughts about this experience that she had over in the global war on terror with this woman with half a head?
No, I don't have enough context for it yet.
I agree.
It connects, I guess, Liz and her, because they both have some traumatic incident in their past that has changed the course of their life. But
so as she's reflecting about this, she gets a phone call, and it's the APF who's posted outside her sister's apartment, and she's called, said that there's someone that's an intruder. And they've found that the place is secure. There's no one inside there with her. She's just kind of freaking out. Implies that this has happened again, but he's using their connection as police officers to keep this out of the public eye. She goes in to talk to her sister, and they talk about her kind of tenuous mental health and that she's having a hard time keeping it together. But she's very resistant about going into any kind of like treatment program, any kind of hospital. And she promises that she's got this to her sister. Couple things here. They're implying that she's recently moved here from somewhere else to be closer to her sister, potentially. And two, she's, obviously struggling with some mental health here.
Yeah. And it seems to be, in my opinion, manifesting in a way similar to Rose, where she is seeing people who don't exist or people who are dead potentially.
You think that's who she saw someone.
Yeah, so she called up the cops hysteric saying there's someone in my house, and when the cops get there, everything is sealed up tight and no one's inside. So, yeah, my opinion is it's very much like the Travis incident with Rose.
So is that telling us that, like, again, is this telling us that actually, that's just people, you know, they're kind of losing a grip on reality that, you know,
could be
the only reason, because I see this woman and I'm like, oh, this is a person with mental illness that's struggling. I see Rose. I'm like, oh, my God, she's talking to a dead person. But the only reason I think that is because I saw it from Rose's POV.
Right. Right.
And I'm seeing this obviously disturbed person, you know, after the fact. So it's like, yeah, I wonder what which way are they going with this? Should I take her a little bit more seriously because there's dead people walking around? Or should I assume the dead people walking around are just other people coping with their shit?
Yeah. I'm leaning toward the latter, but that's my predisposition.
You and I are one of us.
Where I end up on this show eventually, but.
Yeah, what was it? It's the Locke versus what's-his-face on Lost, except for...
Oh, Jack?
Yeah, Jack versus Locke, except for we're just Jack and Jack.
Sure, yeah.
We need a Locke on the podcast to push back at sometimes, I think. I guess that's what that's what feedback's for. Mm-hmm. So then Navarro decides she needs to blow off some steam, so she calls on a guy named Kavik. She steals the seed forcibly. And then insults a SpongeBob toothbrush before stealing it. Moon walks out of his apartment and he's like, don't call me again. You're bad for me. And she's like, we'll see. Is she like, you know, we just had the Britney Spears Womanizer song. Or no, it was a Womanizer. It's Toxic. But she has a song called Womanizer. Is Navarro a manizer?
A manizer?
She's just a manizer.
I was getting that vibe. So this is a white guy, right?
I didn't know. Is he?
As best I can tell, he has a name that I don't associate, that I associate more strongly with like an Inuit sort of culture, but I get the impression that he's a white dude. Maybe not.
I thought he looked native, but there's a lot of room for interpretation when you're talking about, you know, half native, quarter native, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, whether he's native or not, she seems to get pleasure from this, and not just from the physical stimulation, but mentally of dominating this guy, of pinning him down and forcing him to do something he does not want to do. She takes pleasure in that.
Yeah. And it could be like, you know, we mentioned it being rape in the podcast. It could be that they've got an elaborate non-consensual consent kink where he likes being pinned down and taken by her. But with the context we got, it seemed pretty yikesy.
Seem like it to me.
And it seems like he feels bad about the situation. Like he knows it's bad. Yes. He knows this is wrong. He knows he's not his best person with her. And she's kind of bad news in the way, like I said, Russ, wasn't Marty fucking like a 17-year-old or an 18-year-old in True Detective Season 1?
Alexandra Daddario, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Daddario is supposed to be, but clearly cheating on his wife and kids and with a younger woman.
Yeah, both of those people, very bad. Very bad people. Yeah, unlikable. They
self-described bad men. So I don't have any problem with her being a bad woman.
Sure.
But I think that's what we're being told.
That's the story
here.
They're telling. Yeah. That she has some personal motivation to almost get some payback for the wrongs that she sees in the world. That's the vibe I was getting from this.
Yeah, she feels justified in almost in a vigilante way, you know, with the Baileys and the gas tank and the aggressiveness, potentially non-consensual sex that she's having with this guy. Yeah, and just taking his shit too. Like, what are you going to do about it?
And it makes her an unlikable character. I don't think it makes her a bad character. I still am intrigued by this person. But yeah, I don't like her. I don't like really anybody in this show yet.
Well, you know, they're all living in a very depressed town in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
He's a moonshiner. I don't know if that's
apparently
if that's going to be vital to the plot, but they call that out. And then finally, Navarro's having this rough calling around Anne's contacts, hits a rough connection, hears a whispered she's awake, and then suddenly polar bear.
Yeah.
God, do you see how large this fucking creature? I always forget the polar bears are even bigger than grizzly bears.
They're huge.
Bear is roughly the size of this SUV. And this isn't like a Ford Edge or a Ford Escape. This is a full-blown truck body SUV and this bear is roughly the same fucking size as it. It's insane. Mm-hmm. It's insane how huge this bear is.
Polar bears are wild creatures, man. Just the way they've adapted to the climate and the size of them and then their capabilities, it's wild.
Yeah. Apparently they're the most deadly bear. There's strategies. Like if you find a black bear, you be big and loud and you scare him off. A brown bear, you drop dead and pretend to be dead. And what polar bear, you're just fucked. Like that's like, yeah,
there's no strategy to deal with it.
It's because they actually do prey on humans if they can. Whereas grizzlies, they don't really want to. It's more of a defensive thing. And black bears are just kind of pussies. But yeah, white bear will fucking kill you.
Mm-hmm.
Deadliest of all bear types, phenotypes, the white bear. Is there anything else? Like, I really like the sound drop of what's that technology song? The AEIOU by Jim James.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I love that that starts with this scene and plays into the spiral evidence scene. It's this technology. Great.
I found all the music to be of a piece, tonally and just like sonically, I guess. It all
reminded
has
a
similar
me a lot
vibe.
Of like Netflix's Dark, where there's a lot of this like unsettling choral work to it.
And it's got a lot of muted instruments. It's not very flashy. It's just kind of subdued and that sort of feeling gives me the True Detective vibe. Even if it is a more modern sound, I would say, and a more pop kind of sound, it still has the elements that I felt like the True Detective soundtrack had.
It's got that really that came back a couple of times, this creepy nursery rhyme about, I guess, magpies. Yeah. How many magpies you see? There's an elaborate code about, you know, one you see for strange. I forget exactly all the different things, but it's very, very creepy.
Can I ask you one final question?
There's no rule against it.
Why Ferris Bueller? So I think the song specifically has something to do with it, but why choose Ferris Bueller? There are a billion songs to choose from to trigger Liz. Ferris Bueller, at its core, is about a man who gets away with everything because his sister covers for him. And I think that has an interesting tie in here when we're talking about the murder of a woman and the town of Ennis sort of covering for whoever did this thing. Cause there were individuals involved, right? Like the town might killed her generally, but individuals murdered her.
Yes. There are people who actually did the stabbing.
Yeah. But fundamentally when you boil it down, that's what Ferris Bueller is about. And I think
it's interesting. I like that better than the other. Cause like every year when we have a puzzle box, there's always early theories that just annoy me. No real rhyme or reason. I'm just like, that's a fucking stupid theory. But the whole like these scientists are frozen in some kind of swirl, and the interpretive dance was some kind of swirl, and all that. Like I heard that like the twist and shout is an explicit reference, and that when the things everyone twisting and shouting and they're all that was a similar. It's all foreshadowing about.
Okay.
And I'm like, no. So like, yeah, the only thing I came away with that is like annoyance at the reaching, but it could, I mean, it's plausible, but I do like that. A woman kind of sin eating for a man in a situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're listening to The World We Deserve. We'll be right back.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for podcasts that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. We're back with more of The World We Deserve. All right, for our final segment, we'll talk about feedback. TrueDetective@baldmove.com is how you send stuff into us for consideration. If you got a theory, got it, something you want to point out, something to get off your chest, TrueDetective@baldmove.com. Also, if you're wondering what else we're up to, because we're always up to stuff, you can be followed on any social media at baldmove, except for TikTok. We're at baldestmove there. And finally, if you'd care to support us and get some stuff for yourself, go to support.baldmove.com. Some of those stuff you can get for yourself are participation and our Instant Talk and Instant Take podcasts. Record those live every Sunday night immediately after Two Detective airs. Me and Jim give our thoughts on the episode. Then we turn the mic over to the people in our chat, exclusively made up by our club members. Support.baldmove.com if that sounds cool and you want to get in on that. First up, Jim, you want to take this one?
Yeah, sure. Daniel J. writes in and says, to your question about why True Detective Season 4 has a subtitle, one thing Lopez didn't want to be compared to, at least at first, was to the first three seasons of True Detective. But that's because when she envisioned the project originally, it had nothing to do with the show. Lopez says she initially pitched an idea for a project called Night Country, which she describes as a murder mystery in the ice, and it was HBO who suggested it could be the True Detective instead. An idea, she says, never even crossed her mind. Once two parties agreed, Night Country became True Detective Night Country, and Lopez had an unbelievable task of recalling what connected so powerfully with so many people around the world, but at the same time, doing it in your own voice and making it your own.
Yeah, I thought this is interesting and also kind of tragic, because it seems like a lot of the reaction coming from the community is there's negative, and there's an intense kind of negative backlash around this season. Is that it's got the True Detective label on it. And it's unfortunate, because, like, I really value the True Detective subreddit as a place to get theories and information. And, like, so much of it is, like, embroiled in this. It's just continuing culture war stuff where a woman has been given the reins of a male-dominated show to tell a female-centric story. That's the antithesis of the season one. It's all about bad men, and now it's about bad women. People losing their minds about it. It's super annoying, and I just feel bad for her, because this isn't what she wanted. She wasn't like, oh, let me take True Detective and emasculate it. She had her own story she wanted to tell called Night Country, and HBO wanted to silo it up at this defunct brand that they had, and she's getting...
And are you going to tell them no? Like, I'm just not going to do this show with HBO because they want to relabel it. Like,
and she was excited because, you know, like, why wouldn't you be the bring in even more of that stuff and maybe make connections to it, and how fun does that sound? But we can't have anything nice, and
well, this is idiots on the internet as opposed to the critics, who are universally praising this. So
true.
People who don't seem to have an agenda are enjoying this quite a bit.
Next up is Torbjorn, who says, I'm really excited for True Detective 4. Incidentally, it'll air a few days before the sun peaks over the horizon where I live here in northern Norway. After about 53 days of darkness, he's got it even worse. Although I don't find the mørketid, I think is how you pronounce that, the Norwegian word for time of darkness, too bad myself with gaming, movies, series, friends, and Scandinavia, hygge, which is the word for coziness. I'm sure the myth of it will figure heavily in the series. Interesting to see how they'll make it set the mood. I hope to contribute as a listener, at least with some of my experience living in darkness. I always forget that about places like Iceland and Norway, that they have like a month or two that's just fucking dark.
They're so far north.
Americans have the concept of seasonal affective disorder. I'm not particularly susceptible to it. So I actually kind of think it sounds kind of cool, charming to spend a month or two total darkness. And especially if that changes your kind of routines and maybe people don't have to work as hard or but like, yeah, you come back to like, imagine spending and you're just not going to see the sun for a month. Not in kind of like, oh, yeah, it's been raining for a bunch of days and oh, where is even the sun? But the sun ain't going to rise over the fucking horizon for at least a month. That's wild.
Yeah, if I had a bucket list, living for a month or two in a place that either has constant sunlight or has no sunlight for a period of time would be on that list, because I think it sounds interesting. I don't know if it would be enjoyable. I think I might hate it after that experiment, but
yeah,
I would like to experience it.
I too would like to spend a couple years, maybe in a couple years. Now, I don't think my entire life, obviously I've spent half of it already, but like, yeah, a couple years living in a place that has, my brother's up in Alaska, where I think he's like not that far up, but it's like dark for a week and the northern lights and all that. But yeah, I think that's super interesting.
All right, let's see what Martin has to say. He says, why are multiple different characters independently receiving intrusive she's awake messages or hallucinations? Independently arising yet shared hallucinations like that are almost conclusive evidence of the supernatural. Until they show us a giant she's awake billboard that everyone in this town drives past every day, or it's the catchphrase of the local radio DJ. You know, episode one was a rout by Team Supernatural. Team Cynic isn't even on the board.
Well, I don't know if I agree. As a representative of Team Cynic, I'm not sure if I agree with the math here, but it's a good point. That I forgot. It's like I'm waiting for someone to see Travis, another person seeing Travis. But a shared delusion of people saying she's awake in the same period of time, physically
not connected. Well, you've got this
culture, right?
I talked about Sedna. You have this mythological rooting of the people up there. This could be something that they're pulling from their childhoods and the stories and the drawings and shit that they saw that their grandmothers made them think about as young people. You know, subconscious kind of thing just comes up and she's awake stuff manifests.
How would that affect the male researcher at the station, though? Like, he's not steeped in that culture.
Maybe he's been reading
or maybe
about it.
Maybe he has been, yeah. Because I think they have. I got the impression that if Colton, is that the kid's name that put his hand on Holden?
Yeah.
It seems like a native kid, from how brown the hand was.
Huh.
Is that a crass thing to point out?
I don't know. Because it's a dark room. The lighting isn't obvious. I couldn't tell you.
His skin tone's like six Pantones darker than Jodie Foster's is all I'm saying. I'm guiding that because like, okay, that's the connection. If she was raising a native kid with a native dad before, but then, yeah, but I would think that was back in her suburban days. I don't know.
Yeah,
maybe I'm being racist. Always a possibility. I came from Southern Indiana. It's super possible. I'm just being racist. True detective at baldmove.com. If you think I am. But yeah, Team Supernatural, that's a strong, I'm still thinking maybe there's something in groundwater that just evolutionarily suggests that there's a she that's awake. Okay. That's just, it just stimulates those Sheena's awake sensors in your brain. We'll see. Next up is Stas says, I think the crumbs have been put on the board to piece together Danvers' backstory. Clearly Danvers lost her adopted daughter's father in a drunk driving collision. I think she was dating the guy or maybe engaged to them and decided to raise his daughter. Danvers had a brief triggering flashback when she got out to check the present day drunk driver, and she made it a point to make sure her daughter was psychologically okay in the passenger seat because Danvers could tell any motor vehicle accident was triggering for her as well. I'll bet the twist and shout was playing on the radio when her boyfriend was killed. No one hates the Beatles that much. I agree with all the detective work other than actually saying that she was in a relationship with this man. I think it's just as likely as not, but
toward that conclusion, but yeah, I will say there's no solid evidence for that yet.
Because yeah, I could see the daughter saying, who's on a cusp of adulthood, saying like, yeah, you're my dad, you know, you don't have to do this. This seems to be a show where all the main characters are haunted by something in their past. Danvers suppresses what haunts her or tries to. Rose, on the other hand, literally befriends the specter of her dead husband and uses it for guidance. Navarro uses her specter as motivation, believing she still owes a debt to Annie Kay until she solves her cold case. Makes me wonder what's haunting Pryor and his son. There's no way these two have a past without something terrible in it, not in a universe shared with Russ Cole. we know that Peter's mom, Hank's presumed wife, we know this. We think she's dead.
Potentially.
And there's also the hint that maybe Hank had something to do with the disappearance of Anne, or knows about it. Actively possibly. Covered it up.
Yep. It's possible.
He flooded his own police department to move the records out of the record room. The ensuing water bill controversy caused him to step down as police chief. It's all coming together. The picture's becoming clearer.
Yeah, I mean, they've cleaned that. They cleaned the police station up. Get the records back in the records room.
Yeah.
You got this dude just.
Well, he flooded once. How do you know it won't flood again, Jim? You know?
True. Flood prone position, I guess. Adam writes in and says, you said that a few of the early reviewers mentioned a lot of the more supernatural elements this season were up to interpretation as to whether they were actually supernatural or had a logical explanation. My assumption for the logical side is going to be something wrong with the water in town, maybe related to something the scientists dug up at the research station. There was at least one specific mention of the water having gone bad 3 days ago when Navarro was visiting the dead girl's brother. I'm curious what y'all's thoughts on how supernatural it will get. I'm hoping it stays vague enough to be interpreted either way. Really hope it's not another Fargo Season 2 alien spaceship situation. I'm with you. That's kind of how I feel. I want this to be open to interpretation. And I'm hoping they can give us some reason that people would be hearing or thinking or saying she's awake and how that all connects. Yeah, I don't know yet, but I'm with you.
Yeah, I so far as how supernatural things can get, I keep coming back to that the reference I made in the preview podcast, What Lies Beneath, where it's like, you know, did Harrison Ford die because the corpse of his ex-wife reanimated and held him underwater until he drowned? Or when he was down there in the water with Michelle Pfeiffer and he saw his wife's corpse, was he so afraid and so had such a shock reaction that he, you know, he got tangled up in the seatbelts or drowned? I think that's the kind of like, yeah, I think the movie's POV is something supernatural happened. But if I wanted to wear my skeptic hat and be like, nah, this was all just an intensely psychological situation and blah, 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 and people, you know, it's dark down there, it's in the water, who the hell knows what's happened? You could do that too. Anything more than that, and honestly my memory of like Tigers Are Not Afraid is that's very much in the eye of the beholder, that like if the climax of that movie is supernatural or not, you could play some like, oh, it was just this or just that, or so like I don't know. I think that either way, I think Issa Lopez is well equipped to nail that will they won't they supernatural kind of thing. And it's definitely a flavor of True Detective that I need, you know, and it's been there in every single season. So that's all the feedback we have this week. TrueDetectiveAboveMove.com is how you send in your feedback. Again, we're everywhere on social media if you want to find out what else we're doing currently. We're everywhere at Bald Move except for TikTok. We're at Baldest Move. And finally, if you'd like to support us and get access to those instant take, instant talk podcasts, we'd like to hear what you're thinking after each podcast or after each episode of True Detective. Do a whole live show. You can get it for just $5 a month at support.baldmove.com. Maybe we'll see you this Sunday night. We'll either see you then or on the instant take podcast. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.